Malachi chapter 2, verse 17, and we will read until chapter 3, verse 6. Malachi chapter 2, verse 17. Let us hear the word of the Lord. You have wearied the Lord with your words, but you say, how have we wearied him? By saying, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delights in them. Or by asking, where is the God of justice? Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. And the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming? And who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver, and they will bring offerings in righteousness to the Lord. Then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to the Lord, as in the days of old and as in former years. Then I will draw near to you for judgment. I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, against those who swear falsely, against those who oppress the hard worker in his wages, the widow and the fatherless, against those who thrust aside the sojourner and do not fear me, says the Lord of hosts. For I, the Lord, do not change, yet you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. The problem of evil has always plagued the human race. When we human beings see or experience evil, we ask questions. Questions are asked when there's a tragedy because of evil, and questions are asked when there's prosperity despite evil. Questions are asked when there's suffering connected to evil, like the Paris attacks. But questions are also asked when there's injustice connected to evil, like when men make money from trafficking women and children across Europe. And when we see this kind of evil and people who are evading the punishment and them prospering, we ask questions. Why do they get away with it? Why do they seem to prosper despite the evil? And given how wickedness continues to increase and thrive in our world today, the issue is so relevant and pertinent for us. Because all around us, we have examples of wicked people prospering. Just think of Islamic State prospering in Syria and Iraq. Just think of how secular humanism has prospered in recent years. Legalizing same-sex marriage, where Christian bakers are taken to court for not putting personally offensive things on a cake. The Lord's Prayer is banned from public media now. Crime rates are on the increase. There's human trafficking of women and children. Abortion rates are going up. More people are having affairs. People are lying about their tax returns and getting away with it and getting richer. And it doesn't have to be extreme examples like that. You may feel the injustice of someone at work who doesn't do their work the way they ought to. Or you play sport and you feel like you play against teams where they cheat and score goals and win the game as a result. And it's natural to ask questions. Why do people get away with doing wrong things, with doing evil? Why do they seem to prosper? It's the same kind of question that the psalmist in Psalm 73 grappled with, the psalm that we have sung this evening. He looks at the arrogant and the wicked, and he is envious of their prosperity. And it was the kind of question that people in Malachi's day were asking. If you look at chapter 2, verse 17, the question at the end, they say, where is the God of justice? And then if you flick over to chapter 3, verse 14, they say something similar. It is vain to serve God. What profit or what is the profit of our keeping his charge, or of walking as in mourning before the Lord of hosts? And now we call the arrogant blessed. Evildoers not only prosper, but they put God to the test and escape. But instead of being commended for their statements and questions in Malachi, like Asaph was in Psalm 73, the people of Malachi's day are rebuked. Look back at chapter 2, verse 17. You have wearied the Lord with your words. But you say, how have we wearied him? By saying, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delights in them. Or by asking, where is the God of justice? You see, the people were feeling despondent and frustrated as they saw the wicked prosper, and so they made two conclusions. The first comes in the form of a statement, and the second in the form of a question. The statement concerns the issue of God's injustice. The question concerns the issue of God's absence. So that's what's being labeled against God. He's unjust and he's absent. And it's important to see that the first statement is not saying that God is morally neutral. Everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord and he delights in them. It's not saying that God is indifferent to good or evil. That's moral relativism, which is an evil in itself. You know, there are no angels, no demons, no goodies, no baddies, no right, no wrong, just different perspectives, just people behaving differently. That's moral relativism. And it is itself an evil because it is blatantly anti-God. But that's not the accusation of the people. The people in Malachi's day were not saying God is morally neutral, he's indifferent, as if he was acting like a moral relativist. No, the accusation was of moral perversion, of moral inversion. They were saying that God looked at evil people and thought they were good, and more than that, that he was delighting in them. It's a bit like a needle on a compass. You know, the needle points true north. Well, the needle of a moral relativist is just spinning constantly. They lack any true north. But the needle of a moral pervert, of someone who inverts morality, is a needle that's pointing south when it's actually north, or pointing north when it's actually south. And that's what was going on here. They were saying that God was looking on evildoers positively and delighting in them. Now, they clearly had examples, which Malachi doesn't give us, of the wicked prospering and triumphing and doing well in life. And they've concluded, well, if someone does well in life, God has been part of that. Therefore, God must be prospering their evil. God must therefore be delighting in their evil. And so they were saying God is morally perverse. He's lost his true north on his moral compass. True north is now true south. God is unjust. That was the first conclusion that people had drawn. But they were also asking a related question, which was, where is the God of justice? And in effect, they were saying, if the first statement isn't true, and for the benefit of doubt, let's say it's not true, and God is not unjust, then where is he? If God doesn't favor the wicked, why then does he not come and judge the wicked? But because he hasn't come to judge the wicked, because he's absent, then he must in fact favor the wicked. So do you see how the statement and the question are connected? God either needs to come and judge the wicked, or else it's clear that he favors the wicked. Well, no wonder God is wearied in verse 17 by these words. God, of course, can't be wearied, but the expression conveys just how insulting the words are to his character. Because in effect, the statement and the question together, added together, make one main accusation against God. And it's an accusation against his character, and it's this: God has changed. God has changed. Remember, these people were immersed in the Old Testament, And this is what they read in the Old Testament. Exodus 23, verse 7, I will not acquit the guilty. In other words, God won't let the evildoer off the hook. Proverbs 17, verse 15, he who judges the wicked and he who condemns the righteous are both alike an abomination to the Lord. Isaiah 5, verse 20, woe to those, says the Lord, who call good evil and evil good. Isaiah 30, verse 18, for the Lord is a God of justice. So there you have it. From God's own mouth, he said that he is against evil and that he will punish evil. So do you see how their accusation was basically saying God has changed? God said he would not acquit the guilty, but the guilty are prospering. God said he was a God of justice, but where is he? God said, woe to those who call good evil and evil good, but the evil people keep prospering, so therefore they must be good. God has changed. That was the accusation behind the statement and the question. And Malachi responds to that accusation with 3 points. And that's what this passage is all about. It's about whether or not God changes. Did you notice that it ends in verse 6, for I, the Lord, do not change. That's what this passage is all about, whether or not God changes in relation to how he relates to evildoers. And Malachi gives us 3 points of response. Number one, God himself comes to judge sinners. God himself comes to judge sinners. Verse 1 and 2 and verse 5. God responds to the accusation of his injustice and absence by announcing his coming. Verse 1. Behold, I send my messenger and he will prepare the way before me. Now in the ancient Near East, when a king would go and visit a place, he would send a messenger ahead of him to prepare the road or to prepare the people for his coming. And so God here is acting like a king coming to visit his people. I remember in 1994 when Bill Clinton came to Belfast. He was the first American president to visit Northern Ireland. And I remember the commotion before he arrived. I went to school in the city centre. And for the week before he arrived, we were seeing all these American personnel walking around the city. And armored vehicles from America. They didn't trust the British armored vehicles because of the troubles. So they flew in their own armored vehicles. And so for days they checked the streets. They checked every manhole cover. They checked the tops of all the buildings. They checked every shop. The president had sent a messenger ahead to prepare the way for himself. It was all about the preparation of the President of America. And it was an exciting time. This was the first visit of the President of America in Belfast. There was a buzz about the place, an air of expectation. Will he be able to bring a peace deal to our country? But God's impending visit in Malachi doesn't have the feel of a buzz, even though he sends a messenger ahead to prepare the way. It's got the feel of fear. It's not focused on celebration and hopeful expectation, but rather trepidation. We can see this in a number of ways. Just look with me again at verse 1. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. That word suddenly is used 25 times in the prophets and always in the context of looming judgment. And then there's verse 2. When the Lord comes to his temple, verse 2, who can endure the day of his coming and who can stand when he appears? That doesn't sound like a day of celebration. It sounds like a day of examination when no one will pass the test. Who can endure it? Who can stand on this day? Now, the reference to the day or the day of his coming is a reference to the day of the Lord. And the day of the Lord is referred to hundreds of times in the prophets, and it has different connotations. Sometimes it's spoken of a day of salvation for Israel, when God will destroy their enemies and establish his kingdom. And other times it's spoken of as a day of judgment against Israel and the nations, when God will come in wrath to judge sin. Well, it sounds a bit more like the latter, doesn't it? Who can endure the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? That doesn't sound like a celebration of salvation. It sounds like examination and trepidation. And then there's the end of verse 2. For he is like a refiner's fire. Fire is often used in judgment contexts. And then finally, there's verse 5. Then I will draw near to you for judgment. Now that word judgment is the exact same word as justice in chapter 2, verse 17. They say, where is the God of justice? And God responds and says, I'm coming. I will draw near to you for justice. That is, I'm coming to judge. What's interesting is that the question over God's absence and inactivity is answered with constant activity. Do you notice that? Where is the God of justice, the God who won't act? I am sending a messenger. I am coming to my temple. The messenger of the covenant is coming. He will sit refining and purifying. He will purify and refine. He will draw near. He will be a swift witness. The whole passage bristles with activity on God's part, even though they've accused him of inactivity and absence. So the announcement of God's imminent coming answers the question of his apparent absence. But verse 5 also answers the accusation that he delights in evildoers. Notice what he's coming to do in verse 5. He's coming to judge the evildoer, like sorcerers, adulterers, liars, oppressors of people who work for cheap labor, widows and orphans, anyone who does not fear. That doesn't sound like it amounts to God turning a blind eye or brushing sin under the carpet or delighting in sinners, as they accused him of. No, God's not coming to delight in sinners. He's coming to punish sinners. So this is God's first response to the double accusation of his injustice and absence. He is coming to judge sinners. He is a God of justice, and he will come near to judge. Well, there's a second response to their accusation, and that is that God himself comes to purify his people. God himself comes to judge sinners, and secondly, God himself comes to purify his people. Second part of verse 1 to the end of verse 4. Now, I pointed out how this passage has this ominous tone of judgment to it, and that's true. But there's also a subtle tone of salvation as well. It starts in verse 1. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. The phrase, behold, I will send my messenger, is repeated word for word from Exodus chapter 23, verse 20. When God promised to send his angel to guide Israel safely to the promised land. So it recalls God's promise of protection in the first Exodus. And the second phrase, and he will prepare the way before me, recalls the second Exodus in Isaiah chapter 40 verse 3, when Isaiah said that a voice in the desert would prepare the way for God. What's interesting is that the context of Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3, is not God's terrifying presence, but his comforting presence. Jackie and I went to hear Handel's Messiah last Saturday evening at Trinity College. And how does it open? Comfort, comfort you, my people. Isaiah chapter 40. So here, in a passage that's about judgment, we have a hint of comfort, of salvation. God promises to come and save his people not judge them in Isaiah chapter 40? And this saving, comforting connotation continues in verse 2. But who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. Now, of course, the two questions speak of some kind of judgment that people can't endure, and as does the fire. But note what kind of fire it is. It's not destructive fire. It's a refiner's fire. And we all know that fires that refine don't destroy metal. They just purify the metal. And that's the point in verse 3. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver. And then they will bring offerings in righteousness to the Lord. It's the same with the analogy of the fuller's soap. Soap is not intended to destroy clothes. When you put your clothes in the washing machine and you add the soap, you're not thinking, it's just going to destroy these clothes here. You're thinking, I'm going to clean them. Why? Because the clothes are precious to you. You want the clothes to endure. So do you see how the two pictures of this messenger of the covenant speak not of destruction in judgment, but of purification through judgment? It's cleansing, not consumption. So this imminent judgment connected to Yahweh's coming is not a judgment of destruction. The day of the Lord can be spoken of, one that destroys. We'll see that in a moment in chapter 4. But here in chapter 3, it's spoken of as a day that purifies and restores. And the thing that it restores is worship at God's temple, verse 4. Then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to the Lord, as in the days of old and as in former years. Remember last week, chapter 2, verse 11, Judah's offering had become an abomination because of the mixed marriage in Jerusalem. And now here, the offering will be pleasing again to the Lord. Why? Because there will have been a fire of judgment that purifies God's people. And again, notice how this answers the double accusation. Remember, they accuse God of being unjust, of delighting in evil, and then they accused him of being absent. Well, here, God is burning off the dross of evil in his people, and he is washing out the dirt of evil in his people. If he delights in evil, why is he burning it off? Why is he washing it out? The people complain that he's absent, but he says he's coming as the Lord, the messenger of the covenant, to his temple, the very focal point of his presence. So do you see how these verses answer the double accusation again? They say he's unjust, morally perverted. He says, I'm coming to purify my people from their sin. They say he's absent and inactive. He says he's coming with active purification and cleansing. So this second point also answers the accusation. God himself comes to judge sinners. And second, God himself comes to purify his people, the sons of Levi. He is a God of justice. But have you noticed what else it reveals? He's not just a God of justice. He's also a God of grace. Because these sinners, his own people, are preserved, not consumed in the fire. The clothes come out of the wash and get put on again. The metal is purified and used, silver and gold. It's precious to God. There is grace here, not just justice. But the question is, how can God judge sinners and purify his people, the sinners, in the same act of judgment, in the same moment? How can he show his justice that he's coming to show and judge people? And how can he at the same time show grace? How can this day that was ominous and caused trepidation for people also turn out to be a day of purification and restoration for worship? Well, I think because of who it is who does the purifying. Did you notice how God speaks in the first person at the beginning of verse 1? But I will send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And then from the rest of verse 1 to the end of verse 4, it switches to the third person. And the Lord whom you are seeking will come to the temple, and the messenger of the covenant will come. But who can endure the day of his coming? Or who can stand when he appears? He is like a refiner's fire. He will sit as a refiner and a purifier. Then they will bring offerings to the Lord. Then the offering of Judah and Israel will be pleasing to the Lord. And then in verse 5, it flicks back to the first person. Then I will draw near to you. Do you see that? Now, liberals love this kind of thing. Liberal commentators say, there you go, there's an example of Malachi didn't write the whole book. Malachi wrote verse 1 and verse 5. Someone else came in, wrote the third person bits and stitched it all together. And it's all just a bit of a patchwork. But we don't need to go down that route. But the observation is helpful. Because what it means is that God himself is coming to judge sinners, verse 1 and verse 5. I will come, I will draw near to judge. But someone different from God, pure and simple, is coming to purify his people. The messenger of the covenant. Someone who is no less than God, because he is the Lord, God himself. Yet someone who comes with a title that is unique in this part of the Old Testament. This is the first time that God is ever spoken of as the messenger of the covenant. We could say he's coming to the temple with a different name, perhaps we could say in a different form than he has previously showed himself. The person who is no less than God, yet different from God, pure and simple, is the one who will come and purify God's people in a day that involves judgment. And of course, as Christians, we see that in the person of Jesus Christ. He is the Lord who comes to his temple. He is the messenger of the covenant. And that day of judgment, when the fire came, is the day when he died. And yet through that fire, he refines God's people. He is the one who sits as a refiner, refining God's people in the fire of judgment. At the cross, God himself comes to judge sinners because he's a God of justice. And at the cross, God himself comes to purify his people as the messenger of the covenant. Why? Because he is a God of grace. They don't deserve to be purified. They deserve to be consumed in the fire of judgment. But God preserves them. And the question is, why does God do this? Why does he act in the one moment as a God of justice and in the same moment as a God of grace? And the answer is in verse 6, which brings us to our third point. God comes to judge sinners, and he comes to purify his people because God himself does not change. For I, the Lord, do not change. Yet you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. We tend to think of this opening line of verse 6 as primarily about comfort. And there is comfort in it. Yet you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. But notice the word for. Let me read verse 5 and verse 6 together. Then I will draw near to you for judgment, for I do not change. Do you see that? Why does God judge sinners? Because he doesn't change. This is not just a statement of comfort. This is a statement of warning. God does not turn a blind eye to evil or to evildoers who seem in our minds to prosper. No, he is coming to judge them. Why? because he does not change. Do you remember? That was the main accusation against God, with the statement and the question in chapter 2, verse 17. He used to say he would not acquit the guilty, but now he delights in them. He used to call himself the God of justice. Where's the God of justice when sinners are prospering? And God says, I haven't changed. I am coming to judge sinners. But I also haven't changed. And that's why I'm coming to save sinners. It's why I'm coming to purify them and to show my grace. He is the God of justice and he is the God of grace. It's why verse 6 ends, therefore, or I think it's better, yet you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. Why are they not consumed by the refiner's fire? Because God is a God of grace. Through the messenger of the covenant, that judgment becomes a purification for God's people. God does not change. He judges sinners and he purifies his people. And that is why this God is a God who is worth believing, who is worth trusting, because he doesn't change. John Owen said, a mutable God, a God who changes, is for the dunghill. Now, I won't put that into modern parlance, but you get the point. He is not worth anything. Throw him onto the manure heap. But this God, you can trust him because he does not change. He doesn't change in his justice in punishing sin, and he does not change in his grace in purifying sinners from their sin. Now the big question is, when did God do this? When did he judge and purify in the same moment? When was this day of the Lord? Well, Malachi speaks of the day in two ways. He speaks of it in chapter 3, verse 2, as this day of purification through judgment. But look ahead to chapter 4, verse 1. For behold, the day is coming, burning like an oven, when all the arrogant and all evildoers will be stubble. The day that is coming shall set them ablaze, says the Lord of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch. One day is described as a refiner's fire. The other day is like an oven burning rubbish. Now this is clearly not a fire that refines this latter day or purifies. It's a fire that consumes. The first day, after the fire, there's silver and gold. The second day, there's only stubble. So when is this day? Is it the same day? Or is it two different days? Well, the first day, the day of his coming, the purification through judgment, is when God came to his temple. When God punished sinners in the person of his Son at the cross. And sinners were not consumed that day, because God's Son, the messenger of the covenant, was consumed that day by God's wrath. And through that day of judgment, the messenger of the covenant purifies a people for himself. That is the first day of judgment, when God showed the world that he takes sin and evil seriously. Now, I know some of you are into apologetics and trying to answer questions about the Christian faith. And one of the questions is always the question of evil. As I said at the beginning, the problem of evil has always plagued the human race. Now, where's the best apologetic for evil? It's the cross of Jesus Christ. On that day, God said to the world, I will not tolerate evil in this world. He punished it. He is the God of justice. And yet in that very same moment, he purified sinners because he is the God of grace. There's the story of the Jewish man in a concentration camp who was captured, and his son was captured as well, and the Nazis hung his son in front of him and the other Jewish men publicly. And this Jewish father cried out, "Where is God in all of this?" He was asking, why is this evil continuing? Where is God, for goodness sake? And God's response is, there I am. And he points to the cross. Because there at the cross, God does not let evil go unnoticed or unpunished. There at the cross, the evildoer does not prosper. So if you are looking this evening for an answer to the problem of evil, if you're looking for a God of justice in the midst of your suffering, may I encourage you to look to the cross, because that is where you will find him. But the amazing thing is that if you look there, you won't just find a God of justice, you'll also find a God of grace. He is not just there punishing sin, he is there purifying sinners. But there is a warning here with these days of the Lord. And that is that if we're not prepared to meet the God of justice at the cross, when he first came in judgment, then we will meet the God of justice when he comes again at the coming of his Son. Acts 17:31, God has appointed a day in which he will judge the world by the man he has appointed. And he has given proof of this by raising Jesus from the dead. God is coming again in judgment. And that second coming will not be a purification. It will be a destruction. And no one will escape. No evildoer will escape that day. As Malachi says in chapter 4, verse 1. It will be a root and branch job, and there will be nothing but stubble left. But the great good news of the Christian faith is that Jesus Christ anticipated that day of judgment when he died on a cross. On the 7th of February in 2009, bushfires spread across the state of Australia. 173 people died. Most of them in their homes or running from their homes trying to escape the fire. That Saturday has become known in Australian history as Black Saturday. One man, I remember watching on TV, speak of how he escaped the fire. He got his wife and kids in the car and he started driving down the road. There was fire coming from behind him. Fire coming on both sides of him, and he didn't know what to do. And then off to the side, he saw a field that was smoking, that had already been burnt by the fire. And he just went and drove his car straight onto this field that was still smoking with the heat of the fire that had been there a few minutes earlier. And the tires burst with the heat. And he just sat there on this burnt ground and waited for the fire to pass. Why was he saved? Because he went onto the place where the fire had already been. There is a fire of God's judgment coming at the end of this world, and the only place of safety is to go and stand at the place where the fire of God's judgment has already been. And that is the cross of Jesus Christ, the messenger of the covenant. And there you will find a God of justice who punishes your sin in that moment, and you'll find the God of grace who purifies you from the same sin.